Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, new leadership at Boston Latin School.
I have every confidence that Michael Contopassis and Jerry Howland have the deep experience, the knowledge, and most importantly, passion necessary to guide Boston Latin School through this transitional process.
We'll get reaction from one of the city's civil rights leaders who's been pushing for change. Also today, promising news in the search for a Zika vaccine.
This news will electrify and galvanize the vaccine effort against Zika virus. Essentially, all due haste forward.
Plus, the future of ride-sharing companies in Massachusetts. We'll hear from the head of Uber's Boston office and a lawyer who sued the company.
The ride-sharing industry have been protecting themselves from enforcement of the laws against them.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today with the appointment of an interim headmaster at Boston Latin School. Mayor Marty Walsh named Michael Contopassis to the post. It's one that he's held before. Contopassis served as the school's headmaster for 22 years, from 1976 to 1998. He's also the former chief operating officer and superintendent of Boston Public Schools. And today, Mayor Walsh had this to say about the longtime BPS educator.
Since I've been the mayor of the city of Boston, he has been on my speed dial in a lot of different situations, helping this office and help us navigate through the school department on some of the big decisions we've had.
The Latin School's previous headmaster, Lynn Mooney Tata, announced her resignation last week amid a federal probe into alleged racial incidents at the school. Walsh made clear that Contopassis is not interested in being the next permanent headmaster, but will serve in the position for the next year. In a moment, we'll get some reaction to the appointment and the road ahead for Boston schools from one of the city's civil rights leaders. We requested an interview with Michael Contopassis today. Boston Public Schools said he'd be unable to join us. However, back in March of this year, we did speak with him in one of the longest and most in-depth broadcast interviews Contopassis had given on the issue of race and Boston Public Schools. Now that he's been named interim headmaster, we thought we'd listen back to an excerpt of that conversation. Remember, he spoke with us prior to this month's resignations of the Latin School's top two administrators. When we spoke back in March, I asked Michael Contopassis for his reactions to the current tensions over race and education at the city's premier exam school.
When something like this continues to fester and it rises to the level that it has in terms of some of the criticism that's occurred in the media, it creates, I think, a somewhat difficult atmosphere in which these students can learn.
Are there specific issues that you're thinking of?
The issue of students feeling that they've been threatened, if you will. That's not generally a term I would use. But if they feel that there have been slights in the school, I don't care where the school is responsible for taking care of those issues.
Mm.
And I believe that from what I have read and what I have heard, that the school has done that.
But if I may just ask, the Office of Equity's own report said that the most egregious incident that they did confirm was that one student was threatened with a lynching by another student. You know, the student held an electrical cord and said, "I should lynch you with this." And then that was the particular incident that the Office of Equity report says the school completely failed to act on in a meaningful and just way.
Well, I'm not sure that the school failed to act on it. I think in hindsight, there was a lack of judgment in carrying through what should have been done in that case. The case was resolved, but I think what the Office of Equity was pointing out was that the individual who handled the case should have notified the parents on both sides of the equation. I think that's a lapse in judgment. I don't think it rises to the level that some have suggested call for the removal of the headmaster.
Mm. But I guess the concern from, certain parents of students who have felt threatened or the civil rights leaders who we've talked to on the show is that they believe there is a very tense racial climate at the school that impinges those African-American students, for example, their ability to take most advantage of what's available at Boston Latin because they do feel uncomfortable all the time. So specifically that there's a climate at school that disadvantages certain students.
Well, I would suggest if that is the case, that the solution lies within the school and its extended community. My thinking is that if indeed there is that level of discomfort, the place where it needs to be resolved is within the school itself.
Okay.
Remember, we're dealing with children. We're dealing with children who are influenced by lots of things nowadays that may not be, from our point of view, valuable in terms of getting along with one another. I think it's important that along with the exposure to a rigorous academic program, that one of the advantages of bringing students from all over the city together is that they can learn from one another. And if indeed there are problems, it's the responsibility of that community to address those issues.
So this gets exactly to the point which I'm very eager to explore with you, because many people would say that what you're saying, Michael Contempassis, is absolutely true, that this is a community of young people. But the truth is that the community of young people at Boston Latin does not reflect the community of young people across the city of Boston as a whole. I mean, 20 years ago, 23% of Boston Latin students were Black. Today, it's just 9%. And the 20 years ago was at the tail end of your tenure as headmaster. So in 1997, I believe, the then superintendent, Thomas Pizant, we found a quotation from him. He said, "This is a major issue of principle and has real implications for where we are going in the next century in education in Boston and other cities, where diversity has got to be a part of the overall education experience for young people who are growing up in an increasingly diverse world." Now, he said that back in 1997, and when you look today and you see that only 9% of Latin students are African American, and that number is lower significantly than when you were headmaster. I mean, are we not failing here in achieving what Superintendent Pizant was talking about?
I guess the issue for me is how do we address the issue that will result in additional students who are Black and Hispanic choosing to go to Boston Latin School? I don't think that that's necessarily the school's problem. Remember, the school is still racially diverse. I mean, we tend to forget that there is an Asian population there that leads to at least half of the school.
It's about 30%, I think.
30%.
Yeah.
That's the Asian population.
Yeah.
But if you put the population together, it reaches that 50-50 mark. Now, that doesn't condone the fact that it could do more. But I would suggest that it's not the role and the function of the school alone. The district has to step up. The district must ensure that all of the feeder schools have a commitment, if you will, to quality and rigor for all students. You have seen increases in percentages, I think, at the other two exam schools. I don't know what the percentages are, but I think the percentages, in fact, I know the percentages of Black and Hispanic students probably a bit higher. But the idea here that the school is mandated, if you will, to provide additional access, to me, is a district issue. There is an obligation to see to it that the school reaches out and attempts to attract as qualified a candidate as it can.
Yeah.
And all I'm suggesting is that One of the ways that the school is doing that is by encouraging even larger numbers to sit for the exam. But I do think that this is something that the district has to deal with as well. And part of that is ensuring that all of the elementary feeder schools are up to snuff as well.
That's an excerpt of a conversation we had with Michael Contempassis in March. You can hear the entire interview at radioboston.org, and I highly suggest that you do because we talked about a lot, including Boston Latin's history with race, including two court cases which changed the school's admissions policies. Michael Contempassis was named interim headmaster of Boston Latin School today. We did request the district for an interview with Mr. Contempassis. He was unable to join us today. Again, we have a link to that March interview at radioboston.org. So let's turn now to Michael Curry. He's president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and he's been very vocal and active about this issue at race at Boston Latin. Michael Curry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, give us your initial thoughts on the choice of Michael Contempassis as interim headmaster. As Mayor Walsh said, he's only going to be there for a year.
I think it's interesting. One, I'm glad he's not permanent based on the interview you just played. And I think many of us have heard him make comments throughout the process. But that was a nice interview and segment to kind of show the entrenched ignorance around the history of that school and where that school is today, that he would mischaracterize a threat as being something less than that. I think the truth catches up to history. As documents have come out and more data will come out, more information will come out very soon. I hope that he's been briefed in a way that he understands the gravity of not only that case, but many other cases of racism at that school.
So entrenched ignorance is a strong term to use. I mean, others might say that it's simply a different perspective. I mean, I would say that Michael Contempassis knows the history of the school. He was headmaster for 22 years during the period, you know, just after after busing and two cases that we mentioned, two federal cases that changed the admissions policies there.
Well, entrenched makes sense because what people don't know is that the NAACP Boston branch was up there meeting with him in 2007. Around racism at Boston Latin School. This is not a new conversation.
With Michael Contempassis?
With Michael Contempassis. There was a case that we were dealing with at that time. The Boston branch president at that time, Karen Payne, Leonard Alkins, longtime NAACP activist, Dr. Joseph Warren, Seti Warren's dad. There was a series of meetings with Lynn Mooney Tata and Mr. Contempassis about racism, disparate discipline, a confrontation between white students and black students at the school and how that was handled. So this is not new. Contempassis is not new to this issue, and many would argue he failed then, which is why we're here now. So I think he owns part of this, and I think it's disturbing for him to think that it's not about the district and the school addressing this issue and the community, because he sort of implies that it's the school community that needs to sort of look inside. What I often say to him is, you got to remember that the NAACP has been here on these equity issues since the beginning of the school system and our entrance in the school system. So we are part of that community.
So the question of the district, I want to come back to you with that in just a second, but I want to play a little bit more tape from Mayor Marty Walsh at the press conference today when he announced Mr. Contempassis as interim headmaster. And he said that one of the reasons why he was happy for this appointment was on setting the right tone with Boston Latin School. So let's listen.
We have a real opportunity here in the city of Boston to set the tone for the rest of the country on how to deal with challenges that come up.
That's Mayor Marty Walsh today. Michael Curry, in addition to this question of tone, I've been hearing a lot from, you know, families of Boston Latin who say that what the school needs now also is stability, at least, you know, in the interim as these major issues get dealt with. And is it not possible that someone who knows the school as well as Michael Contempassis does bring that stability?
Yeah, I've said publicly that we're cautiously optimistic. I think that he knows the history. He knows the school. He understands what's necessary to keep the school at the place that it is in terms of academic rigor and so forth. That's not our issue, though. We just want to have an honest conversation about his history around the race issues at the school, and that if he is going to take over, at least in this interim period, let's just be honest that he has some blind spots, too, about race at that school. So I'm looking forward to having a conversation with him. So hopefully he's been briefed on the cases that clearly he didn't know about that go beyond the threat. They go to teachers who use really culturally incompetent things when it was said in class, to how black students are treated with less egregious incidents than we have with the threat, and they've been suspended. So I think hopefully the mayor, the superintendent, and others have gotten him in a room and say, hey, where you were when this interview happened with this station, now let's brief you on how much has happened at that school that you should know about. And then now we can have a conversation about moving forward. Mm. I'm just concerned that I hope he's not as ignorant to the history of that school when it comes to race as he was when he did that interview.
Have you yet had a chance to reach out and set up a meeting with him now that he's interim?
No. So this all happened over the course. I talked to the mayor yesterday. I talked to me and the superintendent have been playing phone tag. So I'm expecting that there'll be a series of meetings that he should have with the parents, alumni, students. And I'm hoping that he understands the important voice that the civil rights community, the parent and student activists play in this as well. This is all of our school. I have to remind people, this is not a private school, Mr. Cantapasis, Dr. Lynn Mooney Tata. This is a public school that we all contribute to, that is taxpayer dollars, that quite frankly is the gateway for black and brown students to go to the best colleges, graduate schools, the boardrooms and law firms. And we care as much about the access to that school as anyone does.
Well, so to be fair, though, Michael Curry, I don't think anyone, Michael Contempasis, Lynn Mooney Tata, anyone has ever even suggested that we should think about Boston Latin as a private school. Everyone's always talked about it as the premier exam school.
The reason I mentioned they treat it like a private school, which is the outside voices. They should stay out of this. Only a private school would say that. A public school knows that this is our school. The network of public schools are all our schools. If there's an issue with kids not having access, with there being a quality issue, that's where we all come to the table and figure out how to fix it. So I think that the rhetoric out of the faculty, out of the former headmaster, even out of the interview as you just did, was really about people just letting us deal with it. There's no us in the public school system. There's an all of us. There's a broader definition of us. And I wanted them to know that parents, whether their kid goes to Boston Latin School or not, that live in Roxbury or West Roxbury, have an equal vested interest in making sure that gateway stays open for all of our kids.
So let's talk about that, because Michael Contempasis in March did, you know, as you just heard from the excerpt, he did mention this, and I know you've talked about it here at this table as well, like that there is a role here to play at the district level, that if the district isn't doing a good job or good enough job at supporting all students who wish to aim for Boston Latin, then that's a problem, because one of the most successful long-term solutions has got to be to have this exam school reflect the district as a whole.
I think that people who want to have this conversation but have not done their homework would misunderstand the conversation. It is all of the above. It is about making sure that the academic rigor of the feeder schools is there. It is about the reality that many of the parents who put their school kids in that school have taken them out of the district, put them into programs and schools that actually have more competitive programs, and then brought them back to the school system to compete and be in that school. It is also about the prep courses. We've seen the data that those prep courses go considerable, a long way in getting students prepared to then do well on the exam. That kids of color have lack of access to that exam, those exam prep courses. What I said is when the consent decree was in place and it was legally required for there to be a higher threshold, as you've said, mm-hmm. The high academic roof didn't fall in then. So what makes us think that all those African-American students that existed when he was superintendent or as headmaster of the school all of a sudden disappeared? There's not as many smart black and brown, black and Hispanic children. No, there is an access barrier to the school. And that if they were to open up the doors to more black and brown students, the ceiling would still stay high. And we would have more black and Hispanic, along with more Asian students, going on to, as I said, to the best careers, the best academic institutions, and coming back with that talent. Yeah. Right now, that window's closed for us. And that's a whole nother conversation, but one we're ready to have with the school district.
Now, finally, in just the last couple seconds we have, you mentioned a couple minutes ago that more information would be coming out about incidences or alleged incidents at Boston Latin. What did you mean specifically?
So we've been conducting this investigation. People should know this did not start with Maggie and Kylie's video in January.
Those are the two original students.
Correct.
Who posted on social media.
A year ago. Over a year ago, we got a call about racist tweets and some racial hostility to the school. This was February 2015. We called the Office of Equity. We called the superintendent and asked for, at that time, under McDonough, that they engage and look into this. I was asked to be a guest speaker at the school sometime in October. When I got to the school, the students told me, no, Mr. Curry, they have not done anything to respond to our issues, and we're still feeling equally as frustrated with this administration here at the school. I then reached back out to folks to have a conversation about what was happening to the school. So it was a trust that we thought they had taken this seriously. So by January 16, when all of a sudden Meggie and Kylie released the video, now there's a flood of complaints that's been coming into our office. Mm. So there are other incidents that we've talked about, like the young black girl who the white teacher walks up to and says, "What's up, my N?" Now, some people get that wrong and they say, well, maybe she meant it
as
an N-word in front of the rest of the class. And some people would take that and say, well, maybe she meant it for a good reason. I say to them, OK, what if I'm your male teacher and your daughter walks in the room and I say, "What's up, B?" Or if I think your child is LGBTQ and I say, "What's up, pick the offensive word," or Jewish. There is no doubt that there would be people marching up from West Roxbury protesting my statement, no matter what the intention, because it was culturally incompetent. There are other instances where black students who've done supposedly violent things or threatening things were suspended immediately. So there is an inequity that's not just at Boston Latin School, it's across the district and across the country, where if black or brown kids do things, they're suspended. When it's a non-black kid or non-Latino kid, it's, well, you know, we don't want to call the police. We don't want to notify the parents. And that's what happened in this case.
So, I mean, are these other incidents, are they going to come out through an NAACP report or through the Justice Department's inquiry?
Both. So we've been feeding them to the Justice Department, and we always start with the Office of Equity. That's the way this investigation should start. We go to them first.
Michael Curry, he's head of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And once again, go to radioboston.org and listen to that long interview we had with Michael Contempassis back in March. We talked about the racial climate at Boston Latin School, about the district as a whole, and the history of race at Boston Latin School. That's at radioboston.org. Mayor Marty Walsh named Michael Contempassis as interim headmaster at the Latin School today. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A team led by researchers at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center announced today that they have moved one step closer to developing a vaccine against the Zika virus. Joining us now with more is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health Blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so Zika, as we all know, was declared a world health emergency in February. Mm-hmm. And it's also casting a pall over the upcoming Rio Olympic Games.
Right.
So tell us more about this good news today.
Okay, so it is better news than usual about Zika. It's a study out in the journal Nature just this morning, and it found surprisingly good protection after just one shot of vaccine in mice, though, just in mice that were exposed to the Zika virus. And they got that good protection from two very different types of vaccine. One is called a DNA vaccine. It kind of uses bits of DNA to sort of teach your body to recognize and fight against a virus. And the other is a type we're all familiar with, probably gotten it in our lifetimes. It uses an inactivated form of the virus. So both types of vaccine induce very nicely protective antibodies in these mice. The DNA vaccine was developed here at Beth Israel and the inactivated type at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in DC. So it is a step forward, though, of course, anything that's done in mice is just that. It's good for mice.
Right. So an animal study. So mm-hmm. Does that mean that we are still some time away from a commercially available human form of the vaccine?
Yes, we are very significant time away, although the vaccine development really has been moving incredibly fast. Like last week, the FDA gave the go-ahead for the first human clinical trials, those very small safety trials of a potential Zika vaccine. And federal researchers have said they expect to start safety testing in humans in their vaccine pretty soon. But it's a long haul to get a vaccine to the public. The researchers, for example, from today's news, the researchers will still have to test the vaccines in larger animals and, of course, test their effects in humans. So let's just put it this way. Definitely no vaccine before the Olympics. It's going to be years. There's almost no way it could be anything but years. I mean, just think of the safety testing you have to do for a vaccine that's going to be used in pregnant women. Right?
Exactly. So definitely no vaccine for this Olympics, but
no.
Not even maybe the next couple of Olympic Games.
If it's this decade, that'll be fast.
Okay. So, Carrie, stand by here for just a second because I want to bring in another voice into this conversation, Dr. Dan Baruch. He's a professor of medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and director of Beth Israel Center for Virology and Vaccine Research. Dr. Baruch, welcome to you.
Thank you, Megan. That's good to be here.
It's good to have you. So first of all, tell us, how do the findings that were reported today, that you're reporting today, how do they move the global effort to develop a Zika vaccine forward?
Well, on February 1st of this year, the World Health Organization declared the Zika virus epidemic a public health emergency of international concern. And so the development of a safe and effective Zika virus vaccine is a global health priority. In the study that we published today, we showed that two different vaccines, a DNA vaccine and a purified inactivated virus vaccine, both provided complete protection against Zika virus challenge in mice.
Right. So let me ask you, were you surprised that this mouse trial was so effective in both forms of the vaccine?
We were quite surprised with the results. The protection was striking. All the control animals that did not receive the vaccine showed high levels of virus replication following Zika virus challenge, whereas all the vaccinated mice showed no detectable virus in the bloodstream after challenge with Zika virus strains from both Brazil and Puerto Rico.
Hmm.
And the protection could be achieved with even a single shot of the vaccine.
I'm curious, though, Dr. Baruch, as Carrie and I were talking about, there is this big global push to develop a vaccine against Zika. Those images of all those young, those tiny babies born with microcephaly has really sort of galvanized the world, public health community. But this also, the development of at least these successful mouse trial vaccines seem very fast. I mean, for example, we're still waiting for, an HIV-AIDS vaccine.
Absolutely. And our group is very much involved in the HIV vaccine effort as well. The pace and the intensity of developing a Zika virus vaccine has accelerated because of its global importance.
And Dr. Baruch, I was wondering, can it go this fast because you kind of already have a scientific leg up from viruses that are sort of related to Zika? Or is it that vaccine development has just gotten faster altogether?
Well, the development of a Zika virus vaccine is based on the development of other vaccines for viruses within this family called flaviviruses. We showed that protection in the mice was the result of vaccine-induced antibodies at levels that are similar to other flavivirus vaccines for which successful human vaccines have been developed. So therefore, the development of a Zika virus vaccine can, to some extent, build on the knowledge of how other related vaccines have been developed.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, all this is happening, and Dr. Baruch, all this is happening as also today, Senate Democrats actually blocked the approval of a $1.1 billion spending bill for fighting Zika virus. They did not like certain things in the bill, such as cuts to Obamacare and a ban on giving any money earmarked for Zika to Planned Parenthood. So, of course, this puts the United States well short of the $1.9 billion that the White House requested for fighting Zika. Dr. Baruch, could this sort of political battle that's going on in Washington have any effect on the development of the vaccines you're working on?
Well, because of the importance of the problem, we do hope that sufficient resources will be available to move vaccines forward as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Carrie, can you just give us a quick update about, we started by talking about no vaccine in time for the Olympics in Brazil. But,
right.
Effect has Zika been having on the Olympic Games?
Well, actually, just today, the world's number one ranked golfer, Jason Day, announced that he was pulling out of the Olympics over Zika concerns. And Rory McIlroy is also out citing Zika. And meanwhile, South Korea's Olympic team is wearing uniforms pre-treated with mosquito repellent. So it continues to affect the Olympics, although they are going forward, of course.
Dr. Baruch, one last quick question for you. When do you think that you might be able to move forward into more comprehensive human trials of your virus, of your vaccine?
Well, I should first say that we need to be cautious about extrapolating the mouse data to humans. However, based on the robustness of the protection seen in mice, the demonstration that antibodies protect, and the similarities with other related viruses for which successful human vaccines have been developed, then this does raise a degree of optimism that the development of a vaccine for Zika virus may be possible. And clinical trials should therefore proceed as quickly as possible.
Well, that's Dr.
The timeline is still to be determined. But we hope that our findings will catalyze and galvanize the vaccine effort.
That's Dr. Dan Baruch. He's senior author of a study released today and the director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Baruch, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Kerry Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Thank you for bringing this news to us, Kerry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. July is going to be a big month for the future of ride-hailing companies in Massachusetts. Tomorrow, the state Senate takes up a bill that would add some new regulations for companies like Uber and Lyft. But the Senate's version of the bill differs significantly from the version passed in the Massachusetts House. The Senate version does not require fingerprinting or complete state background checks on drivers, but it does require companies to offer tipping options through their apps. And as I said, all of this has to be decided by the end of the session in the end of July. In a moment, we'll be joined by Chris Taylor. He's head of Uber's office in Boston. But first, a check-in on the status of a major class action lawsuit brought by 350,000 Massachusetts and California drivers against Uber. So we spoke with Shannon Liss Reardon. She is the Boston-based lawyer who represented the drivers, and we asked her if she thinks the Senate's proposal is good for drivers.
Well, I know there's a lot of discussion about the Senate bill and the House bill, and the focus really of both bills has been what these ride-sharing companies will mean and what changes will be required for the benefit of consumers. My focus has really been on the drivers, the labor issues involved, and how the drivers have been affected by the advent of these companies coming into our economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, just another quick question about the Senate proposal. It would require the companies to allow tipping through the apps. Now, this is something that Uber does not do. Lyft does do it. And I know this is actually an issue that you have been very active on. And your thought on that?
Yes, I'm quite excited about the provision in the Senate bill that would require companies, including Uber, to put the tips on the app. I've been fighting for years to get that. And through the recent proposed settlement that I've reached in the case that I have against Uber in Massachusetts and California, I was able to get some changes, including Uber agreeing to stop representing that tips are included in the fare, and also allowing drivers to post signs in their cars saying that tips are not included, and while they're not required, they would be appreciated. But Uber would not agree to put the tip function in the app like Lyft does, which I think would be a huge benefit for the drivers. It's going to mean a lot more money in their pockets day by day, so I'm a big fan about that proposal, that provision in the Senate bill.
Mm. Well, let me get back to your original point about your focus being on sort of the status of employment that that drivers and these companies are disagreeing about, or some drivers. Do you think that there is anything that can or should be done at the state level to further define the relationship between the ride-sharing companies and their drivers?
Well, so I believe that under current law, the drivers are employees. I believe that Uber drivers are employees. I believe that Lyft drivers are employees. I brought cases to try to prove that in court. And the problem right now we have is not so much, I think, with the law we have here in Massachusetts, but with enforcement. Because of what the Supreme Court has done in recent years with arbitration agreements, allowing companies to avoid class action litigation by requiring employees to pursue their claims one by one rather than through class actions. That has been an enormous hurdle to enforcing these laws. So, as you may know, I obtained a major settlement with Uber recently. It's now under consideration by the court in California. It's really a quite, I think, spectacular agreement, given the fact that I was able to overcome the hurdle of the arbitration provision in that case. But that ruling is in jeopardy. So I've gotten what I was able to get so far, given the posture of these arbitration clauses. But this is a battle that will be ongoing.
Hmm. Well, so let me just ask you a couple more questions about the settlement, because as you know, there's been some anger and discomfort about the fact that a settlement was reached at all. And we should say that part of the settlement, Uber would have to pay $100 million to drivers involved in the lawsuit. And folks like Hunter Skolnick, a New York lawyer who's pursuing his own case, case against ride-sharing services, says that the settlement single-handedly stuck a knife in the back of every Uber driver in the country, and that you, quote, sold out your clients by accepting a payout for California and Massachusetts drivers that's less than 10% of the value of their claims.
Well, for one thing, Hunter doesn't practice in this area. I've practiced in this area for almost 20 years. And he never once acknowledged the fact that we were facing an arbitration clause, which the U.S. Supreme Court has unfortunately allowed companies to use this method to get away with avoiding class action litigation. Now, in my case in California, I was extremely fortunate to get a ruling from the court striking down the arbitration clause, which led me to be able to negotiate this $100 million settlement with these other provisions, such as the termination provision, the tipping provision, and the creation of a driver association. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit last week heard an appeal in a related case, and it is very clear they're going to reverse the court on the arbitration clause. So that decision is going to go away, meaning that if my settlement is not approved by the court, the class is going to go away, and I'm going to be back to arbitrating individually, driver by driver, all these claims. So when someone like Hunter, who again doesn't practice in this area, accuses me of entering into an agreement, he doesn't understand the issues involved. It was because...
Can I just jump in here?
Yes.
Because I want to be sure I understood what you
sure.
said correctly. Are you saying there's a possibility that Uber drivers could not bring a suit as a class?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That was the risk that we were facing, was because I obtained this really incredible ruling from the judge refusing to enforce Uber's arbitration clause. I think the case is about to be gutted, and we're going to be left to individually arbitrating the claims of only those drivers who come forward and want to go through that process. And we're prepared to do that. We have thousands of drivers signed up to individually pursue arbitrations. But if we have to go that route, if the settlement's not approved, it's only going to be the drivers who call us up and say, yes, I want to go to an arbitration proceeding, who are going to get anything.
And so this would apply only to Uber, because of the appeals court ruling was just looking at the Uber arbitration clause?
Well, I mean, we're facing arbitration clauses in all of these cases. That is the status of the Uber case in particular. I'm also facing the exact same issue with Lyft. I actually have an argument coming up in federal court soon regarding the Lyft arbitration clause. So all of these companies, this is the ride-sharing industry, the sharing economy, and also lots and lots of other companies and other industries, I've been fighting these battles for years, have been protecting themselves from enforcement of the laws against them by putting these arbitration clauses in their agreements with their workers that preclude class actions. And it's because of those clauses, and it's because the U.S. Supreme Court has been so accepting of them, that it makes it really, really hard to enforce the laws that we have on the books. And that's the battle that I've been facing.
So do you think that this is going to, it sounds like you think this is going to affect any sort of future litigation that you want to bring against these companies, that you may not be able to bring the suit as a class?
Well, I mean, this is what I've been fighting for years, is trying to figure out ways to bring these cases as a class in the light of these hurdles. We're working on developing legal strategies to try to get around these clauses. We're hoping that perhaps with a shift we'll be seeing at the Supreme Court, there might be new avenues to push back on some of these rulings, these recent rulings from the Supreme Court that have limited employees from bringing class actions. And then also what we're doing in many cases is we're just taking the companies up on their word and saying, okay, you want these claims to be dealt with individually, we'll do them individually, and we'll file 100, we'll file 1,000 individual arbitrations to enforce these laws. It's not very efficient. Whole point of a class action is you take care of a legal issue all at once for everyone who's affected by it. But these are the games that these companies are putting us through in order to challenge their practices and enforce our laws.
So, do you think that the momentum is with these sharing companies in this new sharing economy then? Because, I mean, if I understand what you're saying correctly, you've kind of hit a major setback here. with the whole not being able to bring, perhaps not being able to bring suits as a class. I'm just wondering, sort of more broadly, if it seems like political and legal momentum is with the companies that are ushering us into sort of the sharing economy, as it's being called.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite so pessimistically. We have
some people would say that's the optimistic take, though.
Well, from a labor perspective, I'm very concerned about what these companies have done, trying to create the system that they claim is something brand new. That I've seen this in so many different industries. So many companies are saying that they're providing such wonderful benefits for society that they can just trample over labor and employment laws that we've had in place for decades to protect workers. I'm very, very concerned about that. All I'm saying is that because of these legal hurdles that we're facing, particularly because of how the Supreme Court has endorsed the use of arbitration clauses, it has affected how litigators like me can approach these issues. And like I said, we are working on developing strategies to try to continue to enforce these laws. A lot of times those strategies involve bringing the cases one by one, which takes time.
Mm. I should also note that according to Forbes and others, in the Massachusetts and California Uber case, you'd originally asked for 25% of the settlement as your commission, but then later on you cut that proposed fee by $10 million earlier this month. But now I'm hearing you say that if the California court doesn't approve the settlement, any of these terms may not even exist at all.
Yeah, that's right. If the court doesn't approve the settlement, we may be back to square one, and I will be arbitrating these cases for the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt. I didn't settle this case because of the fee. I've been a diehard labor activist, workers' right advocate for nearly 20 years, and that is not the reason that I settled the case. I settled the case because this was in the best interest of the class.
Well, Shannon Liss-Riordan is a Boston-based lawyer who represented Uber drivers in a recent class action lawsuit against Uber that reached a settlement this past April. But again, as she's telling us, it's waiting approval in a California court. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's get Uber's perspective on all this. Joining us now is Chris Taylor. He's general manager of Uber's Boston office, a post he took up in January. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So we won't be able to pick through all the legal arguments that Shannon Liss-Riordan presented to us just now, but she did sort of make one overarching point that I'd love your response to. She said in that conversation we just heard that she believes that sharing economy companies, including Uber, are trying to create a system where they promise all these wonderful benefits to society, these are her words, but while doing that, they trample on labor and employment laws that have been existing for decades. And I'm wondering what your response is to that.
So I would say that she's right that labor law has existed for decades, in the sense that much of what she's basing her practice on are labor laws that were written in the 30s, 40s, etc. And the world has changed quite a bit since then. I don't think a lot of law has anticipated the invention of the iPhone, let alone companies that are worth billions of dollars that are solely based on an app. I mean, it's definitely a new world, and I think it's changing the way that a lot of people relate to their own cities, how they get around, and frankly, how people, how people earn money. And so I think there's a lot of positive development, and so I do think we're positively contributing to society, and I'd actually love to talk about that if you would indulge me.
I will in just a minute, but I'm still not quite sure I'm hearing your answer about the second half of her critique, which is while creating the sort of lots of tangible and intangible positives for society, she sees companies like Uber basically, in her mind, really exploiting workers or not providing workers the benefits that she believes the law requires.
I mean, I think we as a company would clearly disagree with her interpretation of our position in labor law. That's not my personal area of expertise. I manage the operation side. I've been in Boston for the past about 6 months or so. I was in Chicago for nearly 2 years before that. So it's a little bit out of my field of expertise in terms of the company's position. But, we've been quite public that we think very clearly defined within the law, we're following the rules, and we do think we add a great deal of benefit to the lives of our drivers, and we care about them very deeply.
Okay, so let's talk about some Massachusetts-specific operations then, because at the top of our conversation with Shannon Liss Reardon, we mentioned that the Senate, Massachusetts Senate, is taking a look at a bill that would introduce some regulations to ride-sharing companies. It's a little different than the House's bill. The Senate doesn't necessarily see the need to add additional background checks for fingerprinting, while the Massachusetts House does. And I presume that Uber likes
that's not the way the House and the Senate bills were. Neither the House bill nor the Senate bill have any fingerprinting options. Both have a Cori check component. The main difference in between the two is whether or not who processes the Cori check.
Okay.
In the House bill, it's the DPU who would be running that process. In the Senate bill, I believe that's left to rulesmaking as to who would process the check. But both have a Cori check component.
Okay. But it seems as if sort of the barrier to entry, if I can put it that way, for drivers would be lower in the Senate bill than it would be in the House bill because of the differences in the checks.
So I would say that the safety outcome is identical. And that's the most important thing. What it does do is it pulls away a lot of unnecessary hoops to jump through in terms of someone who, you know, if you imagine yourself driving, you're a very busy person, you work long hours. If you have, actually, you know, you mentioned it when I came in, like you have kids, and getting to a Department of Public Utilities physical location to get your Cori check run is a lot less convenient than being able to do it digitally. And that's really what we care about, is the safety outcome is going to be the same. We want that Cori check done. We're supportive of that. But we'd love to have it be more convenient for drivers so that they don't have to jump through hoops unnecessarily.
So can you tell me specifically, like, say I wanted to become an Uber driver.
Mm-hmm.
What are the specific checks or the process that Uber goes through to do a background check on me?
Yeah, yeah. So I would say safety is a really important thing for us. And background checks and screens are one component of a whole suite of safety systems we have in place. So I'll touch on the background screening. The way it works is you submit all of your relevant documents. So, you know, you have social security number, driver's license, registration, insurance docs, et cetera. And then us, like many, many major corporations, use third-party private background screening companies that are all accredited. So, you know, similar ones might be Walmart or FedEx, who's going to send a driver to your home to drop off a package. So, you know, they care very deeply about the safety of, you know, their customers, just like we do. And you submit your information, then the background checking company goes through a very long and thorough process validating your identity, and then additionally running checks in terms of, you know, federal databases, every state, down to going physically to courthouses in every place you've lived and worked for the past 7 years.
Every single place?
Mm-hmm. So they'll, based on all of the publicly available databases, which there are many, they will pull records from every courthouse in an area where you've lived or worked for the past 7 years.
And you do that for every person who applies to be a driver in Massachusetts?
That's correct. Nationwide.
Nationwide. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. I'm curious. I mean, there's so much to talk about, and I actually would love to have you back on the show because companies like Uber are they are having a profound effect on how we live. I kind of want to ask you more of a user end question here because it is in the Senate bill that the Senate bill would require adding a tipping option in mm-hmm. the app, which exists now in Lyft. Uber's been adamantly opposed to this. Now, why is that?
Yeah, so you're allowed to tip in an Uber. You can tip. There were some marketing lack of clarity in the past, which Shannon Liss Reardon has brought to bear, and
it kind of has to be like, it feels like it has to be this very underhanded thing, because all over the, you know, the Uber app and the website and emails even that I've exchanged with Uber as a user, they say we frown on tipping, we don't let the drivers ask. I mean, I feel like I just have to like leave a $5 bill like under the seat.
Hey. Well, so I think we need to be clear that tipping is allowed. And so, like, you know, I want to make sure the record is straight on that one. Tipping is allowed. It's not built into the app right now. So what I would say is that our opposition to systems that are based on tipping are that most research has shown that industries that have workers relying on tipping typically suppress those workers' earnings from a wage component. Like if you look at, you know, waiting tables is the obvious example. People make like $3 an hour and then they survive on tips. And for the most part, when you have industries that accept tipping as a normal form of income, the wages crash down and people survive on those tips. And that's just not necessarily a great system. And it creates a lot of odd pressure for riders that riders don't necessarily like.
Okay. Well, in Massachusetts, I think those jobs that that do have a lower set minimum wage because they are allowed to tip, they're a pretty well-defined group of jobs. I mean, I'm not sure an Uber driver would fall underneath that sort of that component. But
I was going to say, which is true, but if you start forcing companies like through app design, like legislating app design as opposed to letting different companies compete to determine what's the right answer, which we think is a better solution.
How about another option, just paying your drivers more?
So our goal is to make sure that drivers can make a good amount of money from giving trips. Like, that's what we want to do. We want to create a system where riders want to take rides because it's affordable and drivers want to drive because they make the most money on our system. Like, that's success for us.
Well, will you come back?
I would love to.
Okay.
You guys are my favorite radio station.
You heard it here. I'm going to ask you, is Radio Boston your favorite program?
No, absolutely. Obviously. No, my fiance and I will on weekends put BUR streaming on our iPhones and listen while we do stuff around the house. Like, I promise.
I assure everyone journalistically, it doesn't matter what Chris Taylor's answer was about us being a favorite or not. We treat everyone the same with the highest journalistic standards. And I mean that. Chris Taylor, general manager of Uber's Boston office, a job you took up a little earlier this year in January. We'll be looking forward to having you back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.